Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media and WBFO, this is What's Next, Producer's Pick. Highlights of a conversation heard on previous episodes. On today's show...
So we've got this huge problem, and we've actually been talking with a lot of other states about what they're doing. Erie County's been running a little pilot with a couple of companies where we bridge that gap and allow people to take those promotions and move up.
We welcome Sherry Scavone, the CEO of the Western New York Women's Foundation. And we close with...
Every year we get 5 to 7 different groups applying, whether it's a block club who wants to beautify their space, whether it's church who wants to build a community garden so they can stock a food pantry and feed their congregation, or whether it's a school who wants to build a green space so their students can be educated.
Tim Chen, the Executive Director of Grassroots Gardens, Western New York. I'm Michael Loss. First, we revisit Thomas O'Neill White's conversation with Sherry Scavone. The two analyze a report from the Western New York Women's Foundation that details some of the issues that women in Western New York are facing through data-driven metrics.
So in 2010 and 2017, your organization released its Pathways to Progress report detailing the status of women in the Western New York region through data-driven analyses of issues like poverty, childcare, pay equity, education, leadership, and occupational segregation. All of these factors and more play a part in women's advancement in this country. What's the mission behind doing this analysis and creating the reports? And furthermore, what did you find in these earlier reports?
Sure. So we... you know, as an organization, our goal is to create change. And we believe that data is powerful, and that if we can put data out there and make a case based on data for people to consider, that we can change hearts and minds. And more importantly, that leads to changing systems, culture, and policy. You know, all of these issues that we as a community encounter and disproportionately impact women are really the surface of the real issues underlying them, which tend to be rooted in our systems, our old systems or old policies. And so we're always trying to drive change, not necessarily by us, but by legislators, by organizations, by elected officials, to really understand these issues and therefore do something about the issues that are disproportionately holding back individuals in our community, which unfortunately is more often than not women.
And how did you decide that these were the issues to focus on?
Well, they're certainly the issues that rise to the top. And so when we talk about disproportionate impact on women, things like occupational segregation, again, if you look at the data, poverty, the impact of a disjointed and dysfunctional childcare system, the pay gap, those are all issues that have significant immediate and long-term impact for women and on the decision-making of women and really on their trajectory of a career, of a life. And so those are the things that we thought were most important. And this past year in May, when we released the latest report, and we were releasing another white paper each month in one of each of those 6 areas, we wanted to really take a deep dive into them because they were the 6 areas that really rose to the top in terms of disproportionate impact. And quite frankly, they all overlap each other as well.
Mm-hmm. Everything seems to be connected the more you dig. Real quick, for those who may not know, what does occupational segregation mean?
So occupational segregation, our report actually will come out in the fall on that. But it basically is that women or any population are directed into certain occupations. In the case of the women, and we talk about this also in poverty, it tends to be in the retail, hospitality, tourism, and really some of the lower hourly rate sorts of that may not have benefits, may not have retirement plans. So again, affecting later on. And when you look at it, there's actually deep roots back into slavery and Black women's history of not being allowed to be teachers and not being allowed to be certain occupations. So we find ourselves segregated from that perspective, and also by virtue of the fact that many women are also trying to take care of children, also trying to manage a number of different factors in their family, and therefore may be segregated occupationally, again, tending to reside more in that hourly, low-wage sorts of occupations.
Female-headed families are more likely to live in poverty than any other types of family, especially in the city of Buffalo, where the poverty rate among female-headed families is over 47%. It's a really astonishing number.
Yeah, and it's actually double the national average, and way above, you know, state or Erie County. And to us, that is certainly a glaring point that we have to do something about. And that is our Empower Initiative, trying to economically empower women through education opportunities, supported education programs, along with acknowledging their children and helping them with that piece. The other thing is that we there's a group, including Buffalo Niagara Partnership and the Western York Women's Foundation, and our local elected officials looking at the benefit cliff, which there's, you know, more and more people have heard of the benefit cliff, but, you know, basically people will turn down promotions, they'll turn down raises because they're afraid of losing critical support. Mm-hmm. So, I'll give you an example. In our Empower paid training program for certified nursing assistants, when they begin to begin the training, they are very quickly, potentially, depending upon other incomes, dropped from SNAP and dropped from some of the public benefits. And when you look at that, you know, you have to make a decision in your family. If you're somewhere and you're offered a $2 an hour raise, but that's going to put you over the cliff, as we talk about, and you will therefore lose a housing subsidy or a childcare subsidy, although we've gotten that level very, very high. So that's the last thing to go now, thankfully. But you may lose, food, may lose housing is clearly the big one. You're not going to take that $2 an hour raise,
right,
to lose a $40,000 housing benefit, right? So we've got this huge problem, and we've actually been talking with a lot of other states about what they're doing. Erie County's been running a little pilot with a couple of companies where we bridge that gap and allow people to take those promotions and move up. The legislation that Senator Prasad and Senator Kennedy, when he was at the state, have been pushing is what's called a six-month income disregard. So essentially, it gives that person 6 months to begin work or upgrade their work. And it gives them what I call a humane 6 months to wean off of public benefits. But because that public benefit system is so antiquated and has not changed in so long and is, quite frankly, deaf to the realities of people and the increased minimum wage, to throw someone off their benefits is a disincentive.
Right.
To better themselves, right? You cannot blame someone for not wanting to give up a housing benefit,
you're
right?
Being punished,
yes,
for succeeding.
Yes, exactly.
It seems like that issue can be mended with an expansion of social services programs or a raising, as you said, the raising of the maximum take-home salary threshold,
right,
what have you. But as you said, the program is antiquated.
Yeah.
I mean, how do we get, is that just more through politics?
Yeah, it's really policy, and much of it comes from the federal level.
Yes.
So, just like childcare, the Child Care Assistance Program comes from the federal government. The state can put money in. The state can make some choices, on eligibility as they have. But much of the policy and funding for these public benefits come from the federal level. So this legislation, for example, the six-month income disregard, would, as I understand it, be something the state would have to pick up. Now, you could look at it as it's an additional 6 month of cost, or you can look at it as we're actually moving someone off of public benefit in 6 months. And so there's a savings to the state. And it's, it's semantics, right? How are we looking at it when lawmakers are in Albany making decisions and everything costs money? How are we looking at a income disregard for 6 months to allow that weaning of public benefits? That's the battle we're currently up against.
And, speaking about childcare, last December, you were at the White House participating in the Communities in Action event. The focus was childcare. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I have been enlightened and I guess happy that the current administration understands that childcare is infrastructure. Right. Mm-hmm. I often say you can't get to work without roads that, are passable, and you can't get to work without a safe, developmentally appropriate place for your children to be. And, child care is in a crisis right now. We do not pay the child care providers, again, mostly women in the state, mostly women of color. Because of deep roots in sexism and racism, and quite frankly, again, back to the days of slavery when women took care of children. And so whether it's taking care of children or our elders or our less abled populations, those positions are not paid well. They actually, most of the child care providers qualify for public benefits because they make under 200% of the federal poverty level. So we're not paying our providers who are taking care of our kids in their most formidable first 3 years of their life. And so they're going other places, fast food places that have revenue. And we're seeing a lot of centers or at least classrooms closing. About 90% of providers in the state are saying they have classrooms that are sitting there fully ready to go, but they can't staff them. And so it's not a good, and it's prohibitively expensive for parents. So it's up to $15,000 a year for an infant, per infant. And so we have this crisis on all fronts. It's not affordable for parents. It's not accessible for parents because places are closing. And as a small business of, women-owned small businesses, which is most of our childcare system in the state, they can't make enough to actually make the business run. So it's a huge crisis that adds to poverty because women can't go to work, or they're making the choice to continue going to work, but they're expending more than they are in housing and mortgages in childcare and just trying to figure it out. The Child Care Assistance Program is super helpful, and we've been able to increase the eligibility for that program significantly. Mm-hmm. So families can get help if they can find a child care center, right? It's a vicious circle. So, all of the child care plays a major, major role. And, the White House in December, and again, just last month when I was back for the chamber, they understand the role that childcare plays in our infrastructure. But it's a tough sell. Again, we're not, that is not in a paternalistic society as the United States is. Funding and supporting childcare has not yet risen to the level of health benefits and some of the other really important things. And so we're really trying to work with businesses also to say it's really important that you start looking at childcare and supporting childcare businesses in your community as an asset, supporting childcare for your employees if you want them to, to be there. We have for the last 10 years been working to bring childcare to the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus, where, some 15, 16, 17,000 people work, critical work that we want to make sure that the 80 to 90% of care providers who are women can be on the floor when we need them, providing the role and in the OR and doing everything they're doing. And yet, you know, in the grandiose plan for the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus, a child care center was not part of that. Mm-hmm. So it just goes to the thinking, and we really have to start thinking. And the administration put forth the CHIPS Act. So anyone who accepts money for manufacturing, such as Micron in the Syracuse area, has to have a plan for childcare. So we're starting to see that. At the U.S. Chamber meeting last month, Chobani, who's in the North Country here, was there. Micron was there. Corning Glass was there, because they all recognize that they have to be talking about and doing something about childcare if we're going to lift people out of poverty and if we're going to have people to work, quite frankly, and run the businesses.
Right. And it has a positive economic impact.
The ROI on childcare is minimally $2 to every dollar. There are some, the Minnesota Federal Reserve actually suggests about an 18% ROI. Nothing the state can invest in has an ROI like childcare does. But again, it takes political will. It takes a complete shift in thinking from, as I say, the, you know, Ozzie and Harriet Leave It to Beaver, you know, you go off to work and you come home and June has taken care of the kids and has the day. It's just not how our families work anymore.
Right.
Particularly, you know, single mother, head of household families. And so we have to recognize that, mm-hmm. and say, first of all, jobs don't go from, you know, 7 to 3 the way, you know, school does, or 7 to 2. And you know, we have to do something to support childcare as an infrastructure. And, you know, the White House received that message. They have, again, put forth some policies. The Build Back Better bill was tremendous, did not pass, but it was a tremendous acknowledgement of recognizing the real issue for around childcare. Just, you know, as a point of history, in 1970, we actually had bipartisan Congress passage of a universal child care bill that was vetoed by then President Nixon. And so, you know, here we are, how many years later, 50 years later, still having yes. this conversation, when we know during World War II, when we needed women to work, we had to set up child care. Buffalo, New York, first child care center in the United States, Mariah Love. And yet, you know, here we are in 2024, still having this conversation.
Can you talk a little bit about the partners you collaborated with on this report, mm-hmm. and kind of just in general with the Western New York Women's Foundation?
Yeah, we always, our big thing is collaboration. So, you know, even if our advocacy work is done in concert with different coalitions, the Empire State Campaign for Child Care, we're part of the Coalition for the Equal Rights Amendment that's on the ballot right now. We're part of a coalition for some women's policy issues, and we're part of the Women's Funding Network nationally. So we learn from each other across the state. So, you know, working with others and collaborating and pulling those teams together, if you will. These are, as we like to say, hairy, audacious problems. These are big problems. There's, and with little nuances. And so it really is pulling teams together of all of those, including the individuals who have the lived experience, to be able to inform all of these. We are lucky to have a part-time knowledge management officer, because our history, you know, has always been rooted in data, who is brilliant at pulling together the data from a number of different sources, including the U.S. Census and others. And then she and an aspiring young woman from the University of Buffalo who just graduated tried to tell the story in each of these white papers of And driving solutions. So we don't like to just say, hey, there's a problem. Here's the data about the problem. We like to talk about the solutions. So, you know, acknowledge the problem. Poverty is a problem. Why is it a problem? What's the root cause? And then what can we do about that? And that's how these reports are laid out. They are all on our website. The first one in March, which is kind of the overview, the look back and look forward. Mm-hmm. And then the white papers on each of the six areas that disproportionately impact women. Three of them are up. I should say three will be coming this fall. And with each of them, including the three this fall, we do a one-hour virtual education session that have been really well received as part of releasing each of the subsequent reports.
And will there be another full report in 7 years, or will you keep doing, every... three issues in a bunch.
Yeah. We, we have always updated, we used to call them fact sheets. So we've always made sure our website was, we want to be the voice for women and girls in Western New York. We're really the only organization solely dedicated to lifting voice and driving solutions for women. And so we want, you talk about collaboration, we want to be able to provide this data for the media, for legislators, for other organizations. And so we've always had this on our website. We called them fact sheets before. What format they'll take, not sure going forward after 2024. But we will continue to update and elevate these really deep issues that we all should be talking about, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. We want to change the conversation around the dining room table, around the boardroom table, around the, tables in Albany, so that we all understand these issues and understand that there are solutions if we have the political will and really drive to see them through.
And there are many programs that help people living below or at the poverty line, but are there any organizations or entities that stand out to you?
Well, I think people find support in their communities, right? I think the faith-based communities play a really important role in identifying resources. We, as part of our Empower from Education to Employment program, have actually created a list of resources with key people we know in each one of them. Last night, we had an issue with a woman who... had applied for WIC three times and was just not getting anywhere. And so we instantly could make a call to someone who immediately knew the answer. And, today she's doing what she needs to do to get that. So, we try to be a resource, but that resource is all of our partners. So I don't think there's any one, and maybe that's, an issue for this community. There isn't any one organization that I would say, go to. We do, on the Western New York Women's Foundation website, we do have a page that says where to get help. Mm-hmm. And we try to cover a lot of areas. We recently brought 13 organizations in together that all are in the domestic violence space, which unfortunately is an issue for us and for this community. And we wanted to understand what they each do differently, what their area of expertise and focus, and who to call at each one of their sites. And so we've added some of that to our website as well. 211 is certainly a clearinghouse that anyone can use and to call 211 and ask for assistance. And that's probably a great starting point. Again, we're happy to provide directions either by our website or, giving us a call as well.
Yeah. And I would be remiss if I didn't add that also on your website is a directory for supporting women-owned businesses.
Yes. Yeah. So part of our All In initiative to lift women into positions of leadership was recognizing that there were things employers could do, and we have very specific metrics for them. There's things that young women who want to lead can do, and that's our Ready, Set, Lead program, which is recruiting right now for a cohort that'll start in December, and that women as business owners were leaders in and of themselves and of the community. And so we weren't able to do what we had originally planned to do because of COVID, but we said, we need to keep these women-owned businesses alive and open during a pandemic. And so we created this women-owned business directory. Any women-owned business does not have to be a certified women-owned business, can just fill out the form on our website. We vet them, and then it is on our women-owned business directory, which we highlight and amplify. We've, in fact, as part of our 25th anniversary, selected 25 businesses at random to amplify even more. And then we direct people to use that that business directory, women-owned business directory, when they need things. Someone last week said, oh, wow, I called someone who I needed a cake for a birthday. And I called this woman and it was fantastic. And so that's really what we're trying to do is, you know, supporting these women-owned businesses that are so important to our community is a really easy way to access them. And it's by service. So it's, you know, if you're looking for a cake decorator, that's, you know, that's in there under that service.
My last question for you, pretty basic, pretty broad. Where do you see the Western New York Women's Foundation in the next 25 years?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, we, as I said at the beginning, have to amplify the face of change. And, you know, certainly I think our magic mix of giving voice to the issues that are, you know, data-driven voice of amplifying the issues of advocacy, and then of very specifically focusing on women, advancing women into leadership and on women's economic mobility.
That was Sherry Scavone, the CEO of the Western New York Women's Foundation. And we close out with Jay Moran sitting down with Tim Chen, the executive director of Grassroots Garden, Western New York. The two discuss the organization's dedication to community development and environmental equity.
So I think it seems somewhat obvious, but I want to make sure that we understand this. So I think there's this assumption, a house has been raised, we've got these empty lots everywhere in the city of Buffalo, especially on Buffalo's east side. But that being stated, the soil might not be, and most likely maybe, is not safe to be using for growing.
Yeah, so Buffalo has some of the oldest housing stock in the country. Most of it was built before 1980. So, you know, lead paint regulations were not existent for most of that period, right? Maybe not all that period. I don't remember exactly which year it was banned. So there's always that high risk, especially since Buffalo, as many of your listeners probably know, lost 50% of its population once the canal closed. And a lot of these spaces used to have housing, used to have buildings that were raised into the ground. Often the materials were just buried. In a lot of the vacant lots, if you dig down even just half a foot, you'll find just all sorts of stuff in there.
Seemed like a good idea at the time, I guess.
Right. I mean, it's more cost effective, right? And I think this is not necessarily to criticize the demolition of some of those spaces. In fact, in a lot of those cases, it was probably warranted if they were becoming an issue for the community. At the same time, the capacity, the resources were probably not there to make sure it was a completely safe process. So that's a problem now that we're dealing with. I know a lot of the urban farms plant in ground, but they've all done extensive soil testing to make sure that it's safe. And then as far as remediation goes, we don't really have anything large scale available at a cost effective measure that I know of.
What would it take? I mean, when you talk about remediation, what I'm just looking at around at some of the larger scale projects that we've seen around Western New York, and there have been plenty because of just that contaminated soil. I mean, how extensive, let's say, for an average lot in Buffalo, what would go into remediating the soil? That's why you have to take several inches of soil out, I would assume,
probably,
right?
More than several inches. Okay. Right? If you look at, if you're trying to plant and grow vegetables, a lot of roots will go easily more than 12 inches in the ground. Right. Maybe some, you know, some plants like tomatoes really like to spread out. Other plants like squash, you know, their roots might go 24 inches down in the ground. So if you're talking about actually safe practices and full-on remediation right now, I think the only, and you could probably talk to someone from like the DEC who would have a lot more experience on brownfield remediation, right? They might have other methods, but to my knowledge, a lot of it is really just trucking out the soil and trucking in new soil. I could do back of the envelope calculations. The cost would be astronomical, even just for a single lot in Buffalo. So which is why when we build gardens with folks, we just buy new soil from a vendor, build raised beds for folks, and ship in the clean soil.
Raised beds are the way to go.
Cost effective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that is the raised beds. That was a big part, or one of the parts of your symposium. And again, it's one of those things that, you know, it just seems like it'd be easier just to throw it in the ground you're advising, of course, reminding people not to do that. But a raised garden scenario is fairly easy to do.
I think, you know, we had a number of people come bring their soil for testing. Based on my very short conversation with the community partner from USDA who came in and helped us test things, she said that the soil readings were some of the better ones she's gotten recently, which is great. That's encouraging. And also there are one or two that were kind of beyond the baseline safety level.
All right.
So that's, you know, I think the people who come in, get their soil tested and get a good reading or a good enough reading, it's pretty safe for them, especially since recent research has really shown that a lot of vegetables, especially the ones that we eat the fruit of, for example, pepper, tomatoes, they don't take up as much soil, right?
Okay.
The ones that you want to pay attention to are root vegetables, like carrots in particular, I think are susceptible to taking up a lot of lead, and leafy greens. So the fruits of the vegetables, or the fruits of the fruits, if you will, if you want to get into semantics, those are generally a lot safer to eat, even if there are traces of lead in the soil. The bigger thing that people should be aware of is really road traffic. The air particles that kind of come up from the street sometimes, if they have lead on them and they land on the surface of the fruit and you don't wash it, that's actually a bigger source sometimes, depending on where you are, than even direct soil uptake. So that's why we always advise people to make sure you wash your hands after you garden, and you wash your fruits and veggies before you eat them.
You know, the simple reminders that, you know, worth mentioning for sure, right?
But going back to your question about raised beds, it's fairly simple, but it's also fairly simple to build a raised bed that doesn't last you long if you don't have the basic information. And so that's why we really wanted to demonstrate something that told people, hey, if you have trace amounts of lead in your soil, you don't feel comfortable planting in there, you have children, you want to be extra careful, right? This is one step that can make you a little bit safer. And here are the basic tools. Here's the basic knowledge you need to have to build a raised bed that will last you at least 4 or 5 years, be more cost effective, and keep you a little bit safer.
We're talking with Tim Chen this morning on What's Next, the executive director of Grassroots Garden Western New York. A lot of things to talk about here. Maybe let's pull back just a little bit and go a little bit wider. I'm only familiar with what goes on in Buffalo, but is this a national movement? Are we seeing more and more of a focus on urban gardening?
I think so. I could only tell you from the places I've lived and small amounts of research I've done at other garden networks in urban areas. I think there's an overall interest in the food system. So that's one piece of this. You can see it across Buffalo too. There's a lot of food system actors that are interested in more local food procurement, eating more healthily, eating organic, buying from BIPOC growers. So there's a lot of folks in Buffalo and beyond that are working on that. So that's one piece. And I think the other piece that community gardens really offer in a different way than larger scale agriculture is the community connections. People coming together to build a space that everybody can access for free, for to enjoy. It's a space where I think really you're seeing, in a lot of ways, the decline of third spaces across the U.S., right, and beyond. Third spaces as in some place outside of work or home where you can interact with your community. In a lot of ways, third spaces are also places that you have to pay, right? Even if you want to go to a cafe and interact with people in your community, you usually have to buy a cup of coffee and sit down.
Right.
And community gardens are something that increase the walkability of a space. So people are more likely to walk past the place, slow down, look at some things. It puts eyes on the street and makes the community safer because there's more activity outdoors. And it increases those spontaneous interactions that, to me, are really the backbone of building community relationships. If I live in an apartment and I just go up and down the elevator and go to my apartment every day, right, to and from work, I'm not interacting with people. But if there's an outdoor space that my neighbors tend to regularly, eventually I'm going to say hi to them. I'm going to wave to them. I'm going to make small talk, talk about the weather. And that is kind of what forms the basis of relationships. absent the energy that a lot of times we lack to make these intentional arrangements to build relationships, right? Those spontaneous interactions really form that backbone.
You know, it's interesting to talk about, like you said, these third spaces, and I'm wondering how aware you may or may not be, but just the idea that what that means, so what that, you know, the meaning behind that and the potential benefits, whether it's, you know, we could say, oh, it's, you know, it's just a nice mental health break or whatever the case may be. But I mean, do you have an understanding of the value of that type of thing?
I think I understand the value. If you asked me kind of the academic roots of it, I probably knew this like 10 years ago.
Because
it was a phrase I'm sure that was coined by probably an urban planner or a sociologist, right?
Right.
And I think a lot about urban issues in terms of, you know, getting into academics a little bit, right?
It's fine.
Jane Jacobs, who wrote The Death and Life of Great American Cities, is kind of a classic in that space, and she talks a lot about kind of these. She talks about like the, you know, the sidewalk being a ballet of like people interacting, right? And she also talks a lot about what communal experiences look like, what good planning looks like, what good community building looks like, and she touches on some of these aspects when you talk about what forms a healthy community relationship. There are a number of factors, right? But shared experiences, shared interests, and spontaneous interactions are three of the core ones that I think are critical for us to get to know our neighbors. And then I think in a place like Buffalo, where we have winter half the year, it's essentially one of the only ways that you can build long-term community connections. And so having these spaces, these third spaces that, like I mentioned, are outside of work and outside of your home, are in a lot of ways the only place where people might be able to meet other people, meet their neighbors, and have almost like a communal safety net when things happen, like a blizzard, right? Where your power goes out, who are your resources? They're your neighbors. They're the people you can knock on the door and say, hey, you know, I'm completely out of water. Everything's not running. Can I come in and warm up? So that's an extreme example, but as we know, that's a realistic one, right?
Of course.
In Buffalo.
Yeah. Hey, then let's bring it into Buffalo, maybe talk about how maybe we maybe go through some notable examples, perhaps, maybe that you would know in the city of Buffalo. And I, again, you know, I went to the garden walk, the East Side Garden Walk, and had a chance to see some of the really, you know, lovely gardens. Most of those, of course, that I saw were focused on flowers and things along those lines. But maybe just, if you can, take us through some of these neighborhoods, what you're seeing, and how maybe you've seen changes, you're seeing maybe the results that you're talking about, that those interactions. I'll allow you to maybe expand on some of the locales here in the city.
Yeah, and I'll start with just a very quick brief overview to set the context for what our organization does and how it started as well, because I think that informs the growth of it.
Sure.
Especially our growth into a larger network. Our organization started really in 1995 with a couple of volunteers and residents of the Lower West Side who were just tired of seeing vacant lots being dumped on, the grass uncut. So it started for the first 15 years of our organization's lifetime. It was all volunteers.
Okay.
There were no staff. A lot of it was fairly informal, people swapping seeds and plants, people putting out calls and getting everybody to a vacant lot, cleaning up all the trash and building it into something a little bit more beautiful, a little bit more beneficial for the community.
Sure.
A lot of it was more focused on probably beautification at that time rather than growing food. And that's been an evolution that has slowly creeped in, I would say, over the last 10, 15 years probably. Excuse me.
That's fine. And feel free to have a drink of water at time, as I continue to grill you here.
Sure. Thanks. So that's the context. It started with a small handful of lots on the Lower West Side.
Right.
And over the 15 years, there was just a ton of interest, right? Like we have discussed, the city of Buffalo has, I want to say, over 15,000 vacant lots right
now. Sounds about right. Yeah.
And close to 7,000 of them are owned by the city, 9,000 or so are owned by private property owners. And the city can only do so much, right? They've got their hands full, there's limited capacity, and they're probably understaffed in taking care of some of these spaces. And it was fortunate that we could come to an agreement, have a master lease for a lot of residents who wanted to do something in their community.
Master lease?
Master lease agreement with the city to be able to utilize city-owned lots.
The city-owned lots, okay.
Right. So it was, to me, it's a win-win, right? The city is able to see some neighborhood positivity, have a couple lots that they don't have to take care of, so it saves some man hours for them. And for the neighborhood, it was seeing an opportunity to make the space better, rather than the city coming in and just mowing a couple times during the summer and making sure that the grass is cut, but otherwise the spot is vacant. It can be a space where neighbors can meet each other, they can grow food together, they can build a better green space, and it's healthy for things like pollinators. There are all these benefits that happen, right? So that was a fortunate thing that was developed well before my time, relationship with the city to make sure that that opportunity was available to folks. And then it's really grown, I would say, definitely one of my predecessors, probably two or three executive directors before me, began more of a focus of saying, like, these are resources that we should be sharing, not only with Lower West Side folks, but the East Side especially, like you mentioned, with all the vacant lots, with the majority of the vacant lots in Buffalo, and also with the history of things like redlining, right? It's an under-resourced community that really deserves attention and has the space to do it. So we've seen this growth, we've seen this interest level continue to increase. Every year we get 5 to 7 different groups applying, whether it's a block club who wants to beautify their space, whether it's church who wants to build a community garden so they can stock a food pantry and feed their congregation, or whether it's a school who wants to build a green space so their students can be educated, can have opportunities to actually put their hands in the soil safely.
Right.
You know, there are all these people who I think are realizing that there's a lot of value, not just to growing healthy food, but to interacting in an experiential way to kind of be in green spaces, be interacting with nature, and be interacting with one another. So that's something we've seen a lot of.
What is the capacity for some of these gardens? I mean, how much are they really producing?
They are, so collectively, our friends and partners at the UB Food Lab did a study for us a couple years ago. I want to say it's maybe 2019. And they estimated the network overall, which is 108 gardens this year, maybe 107 gardens, collectively produces around 35,000 pounds of food a year.
Wow.
Which sounds like a lot. Right. And then when you average it out to each garden and then think about how many mouths it feeds in that direct community, you begin to say, oh, that, you know, that's not going to feed 50 families in the immediate neighborhood.
Right.
And they're not intended to, right? There's a reason that our urban farms exist too. They are just as important and more important in different ways.
Of course.
They're the primary food producers as well as kind of our large scale industrial system for agriculture.
Right.
And so that kind of gets to the point that community gardens are set up in a way where we're different from urban farms. Because urban farms have specialists. They hire staff. They take care of all that. They get that produce to market, and a lot of them are really focused on making sure it's accessible and affordable for people. That's great.
Yes.
That's essential. And once again, I think community gardens are unique because we work with folks under a model where we say we are not going around and identifying vacant lots and just plopping down gardens. Our philosophy is really rooted in we only kind of work with and support folks when they come to us and say, we want this. I think getting away from that top-down planning, top-down mandate of what your community should look like is really critical to allow people to have agency over what their neighborhood looks like. And that just doesn't just extend to how many boxes they have, but it extends to how our gardens make decisions, how they communicate with each other, with the other gardeners, right? That's all kind of led by neighborhood people who are leaders, are longtime fixtures in their neighborhoods, know the people around, and are able to rally people to do work and make the space a better place. So that's really important to our mission. And that is something to me that sets us apart from a lot of other garden networks I've seen across the country.
Okay.
I've lived in Boston, I've lived in Oregon for a couple of years. And a lot of those places have maybe gated gardens where there's a caretaker or caretaking organization, and people pay a nominal fee to rent a bed for the season. Maybe they get a code to the gate so they can access it. And our gardens are all unfenced, and they're free, and they're open to the public. And that means anybody in the neighborhood, if they want to get a bed, they just talk to the lead gardener. And then the lead gardener talks to us, tells us, hey, you know, we're running out of space. Can you build us two more beds next year?
Oh.
And we'll work with them on that.
Oh, okay.
But once again, it's really driven by neighborhood decision making. We want people to feel like even if they don't technically own the land, they should own the feeling of being able to manage that space because it's in their neighborhood and they're the ones who are taking care of it and making it better.
We are talking with Tim Chen this morning on What's Next. Tim is the executive director of Grassroots Garden Western New York. You mentioned, according to that study from UB, 2019, I think it was what you cited there. So it's been a few years, but still, so well over 100 gardens, though.
Yes.
Kind of fall under this loose confederacy, I guess, or how about that for a term?
Sure. we say network a lot, but it's probably an overused word. So we can start using confederacy, sure.
There you go. Of course, who knows how charged that term might be these days. But to that, though, again, maybe going back to an earlier thought, I mean, take us to some of these places. I mean, I'm sure you don't have a chance to necessarily go around and monitor what's going on in everyone, but at the same time, you're probably seeing... You're seeing unfold there just what that kind of model, for lack of a better term, that you know of a community coming together at a spot and seeing this grow and these opportunities for people. Let's go through some of these anecdotally for you know some of the places around Buffalo, because I think it brings to me at least you know just this kind of idealized sense of what our neighborhoods in the city can be as compared to perhaps what have been stereotypically portrayed.
Yeah, I think you bring up a great point, which is like having these spaces and communities can spark imagination, can let people understand that the food system is closer to them than they realize sometimes. And even if there's no grocery store within walking distance, you can maybe see someone growing a plant, growing a vegetable in your neighborhood and realize, hey, I don't have a backyard, but maybe I can grow a pot of tomatoes on my deck, right? There are opportunities that can really be inspired by some of these spaces that our gardeners are creating. I think there are some stories that we've been starting to collect a little bit. Next year is our 30th anniversary.
Okay.
So now that we have a slightly larger staff team, we're actually finding capacity to go back and say, hey, you know, 10 years ago, we had 2 people and, you know, almost 100 gardens.
Right.
Now we have 6 people. We can actually go back and examine some of these histories a little bit more because they are very inspiring and we just haven't had the time and capacity to capture them in the past. So we're really looking forward to being able to do more of that. I think some stories I've heard recently, one example would be over on York Street near the Little Summer area, which is a very popular garden walk destination.
Right.
Very beautiful little quirky houses in that area and a number of amazing individual gardens that people have curated. And there's a community garden down the street from there that was a chop shop in a now demolished house.
Oh, okay.
That was operating all hours of the day. People were just absolutely sick of kind of the activity that was going around there. They work with Councilmember Rivera, I believe, at the time to eventually get the house torn down. And then I think there was also maybe a dogfighting ring or a cockfighting ring in the back.
Mm.
A lot of stuff that the neighborhood right. just really
right.
was not benefiting. It was detrimental.
Right. Put a label perhaps
area.
On that area. Yeah.
And the neighbors banded together. A couple of people, maybe 2 people, pulled their resources and bought the lot.
Oh, wow.
And they converted it with the neighbors' help into a community garden. There's a very dramatic before and after photo that I like to show people because it is a vegan lot just absolutely filled with trash. It's just incredible. And then we have an after photo of the space, I think just like 3 years afterwards, and it's this incredible garden space. And that was all just the neighbors rolling up their sleeves and saying, hey, we want better for ourselves. We deserve better. We're going to do this. That was before my time, so I can't really speak to kind of the level of resource exchange that happened between different gardens and grassroots gardens that led to that transformation. But that's the goal, right, is to say people deserve better spaces in their communities, and we're here to help make that happen.
I'm also curious, and again, I'm going to ask you, this is more of an anecdotal type of question or inquiry here, but you know, the idea that, you know, again, there's that stereotype that it's, you know, city neighborhoods where, you know, people don't care. And like you said, some, like the place on York Street you were talking about, you know, garbage was piled up and now there's this beautiful space. And I guess what I'm wondering, are we seeing these spaces being left alone by that type of thing, generally speaking? I mean, are we seeing just that? That's I don't want to say a sacred space, but a space that's very special, and that it's getting a certain level of respect in neighborhoods.
That's a great question. I would hope so. Mm-hmm. I think I have been at grassroots gardens since 2020. There are always occasional cases where we get complaints from gardeners saying, "Hey, this happened. Can you help us?" Right. A lot of it really is occasional overharvesting. People who don't garden there coming in maybe at night, maybe not really understanding how the space is operated, and taking, for example, all the ripe tomatoes one go. And that is probably the biggest thing that sometimes happens. And the hope, of course, is always that whoever took it needs the food more than the gardeners. But it can be a very frustrating thing that happens, right? And that's the balance that we have to find between, we could put up all, well, if we had the money, we could put up fences at all the gardens,
right.
But that's not the goal. The goal is for it to be a communal space where people feel welcome.
Sure.
So we have really worked on trying to create more better signage, inclusive signage, whether it's different languages, translated into making sure people understand the garden policies, having small signs asking people to respect the amount of work gardeners put in and only take a couple rather than taking everything. Little things like that that are kind of the first steps towards addressing that. But by and large, I think our gardens have, like you said, received that level of respect. I think about our office garden, which is over on Broadway and Hickory.
Right.
It's a big lot. And there's a lot of car traffic and a decent amount of foot traffic in that area. And of course, our staff don't live, you know, at our office.
Right.
So it's not a situation like a lot of our community gardens where neighbors can look out the window and see what's happening. And it's been a thriving space overall. We have folks across the street in two housing complexes who keep an eye out for us because they appreciate the space. They understand they can come and pick things and sit at the picnic table and have lunch or hang out with their grandkids whenever they want. And so they'll call us, right? One time, the garage door was left open by accident, and I got a call from a neighbor saying, hey, just a heads up, right? Your garage door is open at 6:30. I don't think anybody's there. So that was, and that's not something we asked of them. We didn't say, hey, can you make sure you watch our space for us? That just happened naturally because I think they saw the commitment we were dedicating to that space, where now we have a number of neighbors who are gardening as well.
Yeah, well, let's talk about your space then, because that's something you probably see every day. Probably not spending necessarily your whole day in the garden, but so what would we find over there, Broadway and Hickory?
We've got a beautiful pollinator berm that previous employees built while they were here in 2020.
A pollinator berm?
Just a big pollinator bed along the street that has all sorts of native perennials that are good for pollinators.
All right, nice.
Good for butterflies, bees, you know, the things that pollinate our vegetables so we can eat.
Right.
And you've got a beautiful kind of trellis up front with wisteria coming down. It finally bloomed this past year after a couple years of waiting for it to do so.
You're patient enough to allow it to go. Oh, nice.
Well, I work there. I have to wait for it, right? We've got a couple of, I think, 12 or 13 raised beds right now that are the shorter raised beds close to the ground. I want to say 5 of them are tended to by neighbors who live in the area right now. And then we've got a number of taller raised beds that have kind of slanted sides. Those are wheelchair accessible raised beds. And, you know, they're also just better for people like me who have kind of low back issues and don't like crawling and squatting and kneeling on the ground. It's an initiative that we've been trying to do across our garden network as well, is improving the height of a lot of the raised beds.
Okay.
It both improves the root depth of vegetables, right? But it also makes it so people who have mobility limitations are able to garden a little bit more easily. And especially since we have an aging garden gardener population too, right? Making it easier so they don't have to be kneeling on the ground, so they don't have to be bending forwards and weeding, and they can do it at kind of a standing waist level height. That's something that is a big focus of ours. We have a small greenhouse that was donated. It's more of a little hoop house that we do some seed starting. Unfortunately, it probably gets a little too hot in there in the summer to do anything else. Okay. The ventilation needs a little bit improvement. So that's a project that we're working on.
Okay. Then, you know, you just mentioned like the older gardener, I most certainly appreciate that as I'm getting to that hopeful age where maybe that's all I can, I'm going to be doing during the day. But who is gardening? Who are we seeing gardening?
Everybody. I mean, like I mentioned, we have 100+ gardens in our network. About 30 of them are school gardens. So you're seeing teachers really, and I have a lot of admiration for teachers. My wife's a teacher, so I kind of have to say that too. but these are folks who, on top of their existing job with the school, are taking it upon themselves to create activities that can not only teach a new skill, spur new interests, but get people outside of the classroom. Or rather, get people in a different type of classroom, right? So they can learn in a different way than sitting at a desk or a screen. And that's, like I mentioned, usually on top of their existing workload. They're just willing to do this. So that's really encouraging. And I think there are a lot of other programs out there that are doing more youth-related job training around green infrastructure, around gardening. You look at places like the Massachusetts Avenue Project, which has been running their youth program for I don't know how many years at this point. And that's a great example, right, of folks who are educating the next generation to both have skills, whether it's in marketing, whether it's in growing, but also understand the importance of taking care of our environment and making sure that we're growing things that are feeding humans, but also animals.
And I think somewhere along the lines on your website, I saw a HUD grant came in, or if you were able to utilize some money from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. I'm curious about that. Maybe you can explore to the best of your knowledge, you know, how much is this type of effort, which does seem so admirable, to establish these community spaces with healthy foods inside neighborhoods that, you know, are looking to revitalize or trying to revitalize. How much are you seeing that on a federal level, from a policy level? Is this getting that kind of attention?
I think so. I think more and more so, right? And you asked the question earlier about is this on the rise across the country? I would say statewide, it's getting a lot more attention for urban agriculture and community gardening right now from the state's administration. And there is a community gardens task force that I'm sitting on right now.
Statewide?
Statewide, okay. Right? That's looking into training future community garden leaders. They're building a curriculum for that and hoping to recruit people in the fall. So there's I would say, more funding available for a lot of urban agriculture now compared to years past.
On a state level?
On a state level,
okay.
Yes.
All right.
So that's encouraging. On the USDA level, there's always a lot of attention and support for farm-to-school initiatives to connect exactly that level of education process to more local farms, allow people to explore that potentially as a career path long-term, but also just to make sure that our children, right, our youth are fed healthy, ideally local foods in the school system when they go and get school lunches.
And that will do it for today's Producer Picks. We thank our guests, Sherry Scavone and Tim Chen. If you missed anything or want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Each episode is online at WBFO.org. I'm Michael Loss. Thanks for listening.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.